Welcome to the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, my co-host Arsen Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. We're live. We're back at the bookstore, in fact, with a capacity crowd, hometown crowd here for a hometown author. So, Arsen, who have we been reading this month?
We've been reading John Bassoff, and the book is The Memory Ward, which is a thriller. Has all sorts of great elements that we can talk about as we get into this conversation.
Well, we're delighted to have John here. Welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, the book itself is set in a town, Bethlehem, Nevada. And the town itself is really interesting. And right from the get-go, as a reader, you know something is up because it's being described as a town with houses and rows of pretty houses and rows of pretty lawns. And when you hear that description, something pops up in the back of your mind going, yeah, something's up here. It's a bit Stepford Wives. It's a bit Blue Velvet. And sure enough, scratch beneath the surface just a little bit and you realise something is up. So talk a little bit about the town of Bethlehem itself and why you wanted to set this book here.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Blue Velvet. If you've seen the movie Blue Velvet, the very opening scene is showing all these white picket fences and beautiful lawns, and then the camera goes underneath the ground where we see the worms and all the ants and bugs that are kind of creeping upward. And I kind of had that image in my head as I was coming up with this town. It's this place where, you know, my main character, or one of the main characters, is a postal worker, Hank, and he just kind of walks around and everybody waves to him and says, how are you doing? And good morning. But then they look at him a little bit too long. You know, it's one of those places. And there's sort of, even though it takes place in contemporary times, I wanted it to have sort of a 1950s feel to it. Just that sense of kind of nuclear paranoia, where you feel like maybe people are being nice to your face, but there's some deep dark secret going on somewhere, and so that's Bethlehem. And it's, you know, it's a big character in the book. I think most of the books that I write, the setting becomes a character, and Bethlehem is no different.
And the name, I mean, it sounds almost biblical, but it's not. I mean, was the name inspired by an actual Bethlehem or?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking kind of that contrast between Bethlehem, where Jesus is from, and then maybe Bedlam, the insane asylum. So somewhere, you know, maybe both of those things.
Very apt, very yeah. apt.
So I had recently shown my daughter, who's 16, The Truman Show. And this town reminded me quite a bit of that kind of setting where, yeah, like you said, the very niceness of things kind of creeps you out. And I wonder, so you talked about Blue Velvet, Truman Show. Did you have other inspirations, or were there things that you were trying to write away from? Like, I don't want it to be too much like that.
Yeah, I mean, I was conscious because there are some Truman Show elements to it. So which I liked, but I didn't want to get too close to it. So it was, I think the bigger challenge was pushing away from those kind of things. You know, the town I live in, Longmont, has elements of kind of the suburban idyllic where everybody is happy and everybody's got their you know, bushes put the exact right way, and we've got a certain number of colors that we can have on our houses and so forth. So there was a little bit of the learned experience, or the experience that I put into the book, and then there was, yeah, certainly influences of those kind of David Lynch type of towns, and certainly The Truman Show was an influence as well.
The time period was interesting because you mentioned you were kind of inspired like the 1950s, because that's what we're familiar with, certainly in cultural references. It's this 1950s suburbia. But the time setting is a little bit ambiguous because you have different references, like TV shows that are playing. So at one point, I Love Lucy's on, but it's a rerun, but then MASH is on. And so it's a little bit unsettling because I'm like, when is this all set? And the modern elements that you might associate with, like, say, internet or smartphones aren't really obvious. And so were you trying to be deliberately ambiguous with the time as well?
Yes. Yeah. I wanted there to be, I mean, the protagonist, the characters in the book are all kind of confused. And I wanted the readers to be confused as well about where they were and what exactly is happening. And so, yeah, there are some pop culture references, but they, I mean, it's one of those towns where you might have something very current on TV, but then you'll hear down the road a kind of an unsettling melody from the 1950s. You know, you might have the, "Are you lonesome tonight?" Just kind of eerily echoing off the buildings there. And so it is a little confusing about when it takes place. And it's, I don't think there's ever a time where it says, you know, 2015. It's just kind of left up to the audience.
So you have a couple lead characters. The book is told in first person. We start with Hank, then we move to Wally. Can you tell us about these two characters and some of their similarities?
Well, Hank and Wally seem really similar because they both are postal workers. They both have, I don't know, they both have similar ways of talking. I don't want to give any spoilers, but there's some other things that kind of connect them. But then there's also some major differences between them. Hank lives with his wife, beautiful young woman named Iris, who is, you know, kind of your stereotypical 1950s housewife who's there taking care of things. And then Wally lives with his father, who is suffering from dementia. As a reader, we're trying to figure out, all right, these guys have these kind of, in some way, parallel lives, but they also have very different things going on. One of them, one of their mother is dead. The other one's mother is living. And so, yeah, some more of that kind of disorientation.
And they're both recovering from an accident. And that seems to be a theme as you meet some other characters too, the accident, right?
Yeah, so we have three main narrators and then a fourth that appears kind of briefly. And all of them have some sort of trauma that they've dealt with, an accident or something vague that's happened to them that they're recovering from. They're being treated by a doctor. The one character that's different in that is Wally. I hope I get all the names straight because... And Wally is, his father is being treated by this doctor. So you have these other characters who they themselves are being treated by this mysterious doctor, Dr. Hoover, which also brings back a little of that 1950s feel. And then you have one whose father is. And so we're trying to figure out what is the connection there.
Well, Dr. Hoover pays house visits, so that's a big tell that it's not 2025, because I don't know the last time a doctor would pay a house visit.
My doctor comes to my house all the time. What are you talking about?
I don't know what health plan you're on at Longmont High, but I want to get on it. Anyway, so Dr. Hoover shows up, and he's there because Wally's dad has dementia. So this whole idea around memory, I mean, obviously the book is called The Memory Ward, but Wally is doubting his memories. There's a lot of angst about his memories, and then we have the backdrop of dementia as well. So this idea of memories, what they mean about your sense of self, where did that idea come from? Why did you want to explore that?
I mean, I've written 10 novels, and I think you kind of have your obsessions that you're always trying to work through, and pretty much all of my novels deal with memory and identity and just what it means to be human and whether we can remain human if we don't have those memories. And my son was talking to me about, I don't know, I'm sure more educated people will know what this is called, but this idea of if you have a ship and you begin taking pieces away, when does it stop being that original ship? Like, how many pieces? Is it one? Is it two? Is it when you only have one piece left? When is it no longer that? And same kind of thing with your memories. If you begin losing your memories, how much has to go away until you're no longer the same person anymore? And I know families who have people who struggle with Alzheimer's or dementia probably deal with that. Like, this is not the same person that I used to know. So there's a little bit of that in the memory ward. But yeah, I've always been obsessed with memory. And I think it's a good, just for fiction, it's a good plot device because it can confuse the characters, confuse the readers, and just kind of adds that intriguing layer.
One of the things I got along these lines, though, is there's something even deeper than memory that forms your core identity. Like, there's an identity separate from memory, it seems like, is one of the messages of the book in a way. Even if you don't know who you are, you're still you. And trying to get at that essence, that core of what a person is, I thought was part of what was being stripped away here. Like, when you really get to the bottom of it, is it truly our specific memories? Because as we know, as science has shown us, people's memories are faulty. Like, your memory isn't even really the true true event in many kinds, especially your childhood memories.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think that's the big central question. I don't know if there's a clear answer in the book, maybe, depending on how you read it, but that question of, do you remain the same person even without the memories? Are you the same? Are you the same person? Do you have choice in what you do? There's like, have you ever read the book, the Dashiell Hammett book, Maltese Falcon? And in that book, the main character, Sam Spade, tells this story about this man named Flitcraft who is living this very mundane life. And he's, you know, he goes to work each day and he's got the two kids and the wife and miserable, right, Toby? And then at some point, he has like this near-death experience and this thing from the building falls and almost kills him. And he decides, I'm starting all over. I'm going to go do something completely different. And he disappears. And then years later, 20, 30 years later, they find him and he's moved to another town like 10 miles away, married somebody else, had two kids, working the same job. And so it's like, are we just drawn, who we are, just drawn to kind of repeat that same thing over and over again? So that's one of the central questions as well.
So I want to have you read two passages in the book.
Okay.
So, 'cause the book is, I think it's described in the back as kind of a Russian doll type of thing, a narrative within a narrative within a narrative. So the first piece will be Hank, and then the second piece will be Wally. And if you want to say any more to set them up, go ahead. But
yeah, so Hank is the first one that we get. He's the first narrator, and he's the one who has the wife named Iris, and he's a postal worker. And so here's kind of the one of the mundane openings. I was walking down Spruce Street, humming some nameless melody, thinking about days gone by, when I stumbled over a branch that had fallen from a nearby tree. I managed to keep my balance, but in that momentary anticipation of contact with the cement, my hand opened and several pieces of mail fluttered to the ground. Cursing quietly, I got down on my hands and knees and worked to gather the scattered mail. But among the fallen envelopes, I noticed that one, addressed to Dolly Harvey, had become unsealed, the folded letter jutting out from the corner. The address was written in lovely looped cursive, and below the address was an intricate rose colored red. I glanced around and, seeing that nobody was around, extracted the piece of paper from the envelope. Why did I do that? Did I expect to find a passionate letter from a secret lover? A lurid blackmail message from an aggrieved enemy? It's hard to say. Sometimes we do things for no reason at all. When I unfolded the piece of white printer paper, however, I was disappointed to find that it was blank. I flipped it over. Nothing. No promises of love. No angry threats. No writing at all. Huh, I said out loud. Then I placed the piece of paper back in the envelope. And now we have Wally, who's the second narrator, and he's the one who lives with his father, who suffers from dementia. I was walking down Spruce Street, humming some nameless melody, thinking about days gone by, when I stumbled over a branch that had fallen from a nearby tree. I managed to keep my balance, but in that momentary anticipation of contact with the cement, my hand opened and several pieces of mail fluttered to the ground. Cursing gently, I got down on my hands and knees and worked to gather the scattered mail. But among the fallen envelopes, I noticed that one, addressed to Dolly Harvey, had become unsealed, the folded letter jutting out from the corner. The address was written in lovely looped cursive, and below the address was an intricate rose colored red. I glanced around and, seeing that nobody was around, began to extract the piece of paper from the envelope. But I never got the paper out, because that's when I heard somebody screaming. It was coming from just up the block. Not a scream of delight, not a scream of surprise, a scream of terror. For several moments, I didn't move. It was as if I were completely paralyzed. Eventually, I managed to pull a leg forward. And then another. I glanced around. The world, as always, was empty. Better to ignore the sound, I thought. After all, it's a mailman's job to deliver mail, not to patrol the neighborhood. And besides, I had never been known for my courage. But after a short respite, the shrieking continued, and it somehow sounded even more desperate, even more blood-curdling. Maybe it was instinct, maybe something else, but the next thing I knew, I was walking and then running toward the direction of the sound.
That's John Bassoff, who's reading from The Memory Ward, his latest book. And that is part of the Radio Book Club for this month. And John is joining us live at the Boulder Bookstore in front of a live audience. So two different narrators there, two different mailmen, and two different outcomes after they basically both had the same experience tripping over. But the second mailman doesn't get to see the envelope. But he, that scream really brings us into a much darker part of the story. And so I thought at that point, it was like, oh, this is a psychological thriller. But when the scream happened and then we realized what caused the scream, it was like, this is much darker. It's almost horror. So did you have a sense of genre when you were writing this, or when you were pitching it to your agent or the publisher? Because it really does encapsulate so and hops in between lots of different genres.
Yeah, you know, I've always felt like I'm a genre writer, but I don't know what genre I'm in. And it's always been a mystery. My agent sitting over there, I'm sure it's very frustrating to her, because, you know, having genres is a nice way for bookstores to be able to organize things and to know what to expect. I write dark stuff, and I feel like this is fits into that nicely. This is dark. Some people say it's horror. Some people say, I mean, there's some maybe even elements of science fiction in here. So, but it does, I do feel fully like a genre writer. And even though some of it might feel a little literary, it's like that's the tradition that I want to be a part of.
It's interesting because I'm kind of, as the buyer here, until the pandemic, we didn't have romance or horror sections because we had them in the 90s and they didn't really sell. And so then we just moved everything into fiction. But now we've separated them back out. And so it's kind of interesting how people want that template kind of to see what they're getting into. Where I've always just kind of read widely. And so I don't personally like it. Like, I'd rather just everything being fiction. Like you said, you were teaching Lord of the Flies. Would that be a horror novel now? Or is that just general fiction, you know? So you say you want to be a genre writer. How, when you think about what you teach your students and what books in the past might have been put into genres and maybe they wouldn't have been seen as widely, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it does. It's like a losing argument because there is no pure definition of it. When I think of genre writing, I think of a story that really that moves in a certain direction and that ends up, having twists and having some kind of a resolution. Literary, you can maybe have a little bit more freedom of exploring different characters and moving around. And I think genre has there's certain expectations that when you read genre, you're going to have each chapter is going to move you a little bit closer towards what you're trying to achieve there at the end. You know, like this book has, it's not a spoiler to say that the end is somewhat ambiguous, but I think there's a difference between having an ambiguous ending and then having an ending where you're just kind of screwing the reader, you know, saying, aha, I fooled you into reading this entire thing and you don't know what happened. There's just going to be a lot of interpretations about what happens at the end. And I think that's good. And it's something that people can talk about. And if you have book clubs, it's like, you know, a fun thing. Here's what I think happened. And well, here's what I think happened. And actually, when I turned this in to my, when I was working on this with my editor and she finished, she said, is this what happened at the end? And she asked me and I said, no. And she said, okay, good. Cause I like what you said better. So, you know.
So when you're trying to keep track of that, right? So we have two different narrators, two different timelines, lots of different memories. There's a lot to keep track of. How do you organize your writing process to make sure that if you're referring to something that happened in one particular timeline, you know what I mean? Like, do you have a system of keeping it all straight?
No, it's why I've spent many months in various asylums and so forth. But no, I do. I'm like very meticulous before I write it. I'll have like each character, I'll have their chronology of like, you know, from the time they were born till the time the story ends. And then, you know, the trick is always figuring out what do you want to reveal to who and when. And
so you've got the timing of when you're going to be dropping these clues and the reveals. That's so strategic and it has to be done in a way that you don't want to give it all away too soon, right?
Yeah, because you're thinking of, first of all, the characters themselves, like what do you want to give away, or what do the characters know and when? And then your readers as well. And they have to, you know, you've got to be honest as a writer, like you need to know what's going on, because it's not enough just to say, well, I don't know what's going on, but hopefully my readers will have some interpretation that makes sense. So I feel like I've kind of, you know, I'm pretty consistent with knowing what's happened with each character. And then And then, you know, as the writer, you make those choices. All right, how do I want to reveal this and when? And especially when you're doing with different narrators and kind of different timelines, there's a little bit of, I guess, of the art there more than the science of when you want to do things. But for me, that's always the most difficult time, is that, like, that planning piece. So there, you know, there's the planning, and then there's the writing, and there's the revising. I love the revising because I've already got something there that I can kind of manipulate and make better. But that first part where I'm trying to figure everything out, that's when I'm just lying in bed, just totally miserable. So,
so you have like a kind of a release valve, I think, in this book, in that lots of dreams come up. So you have people who are struggling with their memory, or maybe are misremembering or whatever. But, and then there's dreams. And in the dreams is kind of an indirect way of getting at things. So where maybe the reader gets some information that even the dreamer themselves doesn't necessarily get in the same way. So talk about writing dreams into your stories, how they function, and how weird can you get in them, and because you don't want to be too direct with them, but at the same time, how far out can you get with them?
Yeah, it's that weird balance, because I remember once my wife and I, Toby, were driving with our kids somewhere and listening to some book, and it was really good, but then they would keep cutting to dreams. We're like, we don't want to hear dreams. This isn't real. So you got to be careful not to do too much with dreams, because, you know, we want to get the story going. But dreams are a useful way to give some information about what this character's experiencing that they're not aware of, and giving that information to the reader, hopefully. And I do like writing some dream sequences, because you can be kind of totally off the wall and crazy with it. Like at the end of this book, I remember there were some dream sequences near the end. Don't worry, it doesn't end with "it was all a dream." but there's some dream sequences, and I ended up cutting some of them because it just went on a little bit too long. I think I enjoy writing them too much. But the entire narrative has kind of a dream-like quality to it. And I don't know if it has so much dream logic in it, where, you know, in dream logic, characters are kind of moving from one place to another with no explanation, and new people are appearing. But there is just kind of a sense of unease, of a kind of a blurring line of what's real and what is and what's not real, or even delusional.
So you started it 3 years ago?
Yeah, I think this book was finished probably about 3 years ago. So I probably started writing about 4 years ago.
So that was tail end of COVID? This is a COVID book.
I think so.
So just these ideas of paranoia, not trusting what you see. I mean, so much of this has echoes of what we're living through.
Yeah.
How much of what is happening, well, what was happening 3 years ago, was seeping in to your writing?
Yeah, I mean, I've never started out by trying to write a political book, because I think that usually ends up being a little contrived. You know, you're like trying too hard to do something. But I think every book is still political, and I still think you're influenced by what's going on around you. And I think at the time with COVID, there was so much with still is, obviously, conspiracy theories and so forth. And so in this book, a lot of the stuff that happens has that feel of like, is this really, like, you know, can I believe all these people who are saying this one thing, or saying these crazy things, or is this the reality? And I mean, it's become harder and harder. It's hard for me sometimes when I, like, if I'm on social media too long, I'll be like, well, maybe this is real. Maybe Melania Trump does not exist anymore, and it's just there's some actress in her place. Like, I'm seeing some good evidence here, and there's some of that, I think, in the memory ward.
Well, and especially because we talked about one doctor, but there's another doctor, and there's this idea that nefarious scientists are out there too. I mean, that's very much resonating with what's happening currently. Well, I guess that was happening 3 years ago too.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the grand tradition of fiction to have, you know, either the government or the doctors or the corporation as being kind of the nefarious ones you can't trust. And here again, like, a lot of this depends on how you're reading it, on who you're going to trust or not. There might be some people who are reading it or like, I think Dr. Hoover and the other doctor, the more kind of mysterious doctor, Zagorski, I think they're the trustworthy ones. You know, you could read it that way. We're also influenced a lot by the person telling the story. And when you have one person telling the story who's obviously very suspicious of these doctors, I think it's natural that the readers become suspicious of them as well.
One of the things I liked about this book was it, it just gave my imagination so much room to roam, partially because you do have a tight point of view, you know, the first person point of view from these people that you're trying to figure out what's going on with them. But then my imagination would go to the people around them. Like, if it's like the Truman Show and they're just acting, what are the ethics of that? Like, you're acting as this person's wife as like a full-time job. And I thought of some books that had come out last year. Creation Lake is by Rachel Kushner. It's a very different kind of book, but the main character is a spy, and she to get embedded into this group of terrorists or whatever she's trying to, she has to have a relationship with this person. And so that book was from that point of view and made me think of all these other characters in your story. And as a writer, are you so honed in on your point of view, or do you kind of let your imagination roam to like, okay, what's it like for Iris? What's it like for the guy who's the dad, you know, with dementia?
I mean, I think I'm primarily focused on my narrators and my protagonists and their because it's their experience of the world. So every single person in their life is through their vision you could, if this story was written from a different point of view, if it was written from Iris's point of view, you would have a totally different story, and the ethics would probably change, and your view of the ethics would change. There's somewhat of that with Wally's father, who kind of gives us a speech towards the end, and you kind of have a shift of your view of him. There are a lot of side interesting characters, and it would be fun. I'm not like a guy who does sequels or anything like that. I never have, because I get too tired of my characters. I get too tired of myself and my thoughts. I'm like, I gotta move on somewhere else. But there are a lot of interesting side characters, and it would be kind of fun to see what their stories are. So if this was like a TV series, are there any producers out there? If this was a TV series, you could have a lot of these like side characters and have their own plot lines.
Yeah, well, and also fan fiction's a big thing. So who knows, maybe there's somebody out there who's going to write a short story from Iris's point of view or something.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned the ending. Did you ever have a different ending in mind? I mean, I think it's ambiguous enough that we can all figure out an ending that fits how we've read the book, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about the book, and you talked earlier about how you read the book kind of, that will inform whether or not you see the doctors as being evil or whether you see other characters. And I've changed my mind actually several times as I've been thinking about it. And so how do you balance an ending with that? Like, did you have any other endings in mind? And was the ending something that was just kind of looming? It was like, I really got to pull this ending off.
Yeah, I always knew how it was going to end. From whenever I write a book, the two things I know is how it's going to start and how it's going to end. Not necessarily the exact paragraph or how, like, there was some things that changed in the writing and some of the, because new characters will appear that I hadn't expected and different plot elements will come that I hadn't expected, but I had a general idea, this is what I want to have happen at the end. You know, hopefully the ending is, I guess there's a difference between having like a satisfying ending and an ending that kind of sticks with you. I feel like this one is probably gonna be one that sticks with you, that you kind of think about for a while. And as you said, you've changed your mind a few times on it. I love like watching, when I watch a show and I'm not that smart, so then I have no idea what just happened. And then I'll go on to Reddit or something. I'm like, oh, that's an interesting theory and so forth. So I think it would be cool if people were doing that with my book as well.
The book is The Memory Ward. It's the latest book by our guest, John Bassoff. And he has been joining us here at the Radio Book Club. Thank you so much.
I'm glad to be here.
But as we always do at the end of each radio episode, we announce what we're reading for the next month. So, Arsene, for the month of May, what are we reading?
We're going to be bringing back Stephen Graham Jones for like the sixth time in 10 or 11 years here. And his new book is called Buffalo Hunter Hunter. This is a historical novel. It's an American Indian revenge story going back to a massacre of 217 Blackfeet Indian in the 1870s. There's a priest and a vampire involved.
Do tune in May for that. In the meantime, please subscribe to the Radio Book Club podcast so you never miss an episode. Live from the Boulder Bookstore, you have been listening to the Radio Book Club. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, my co-host, Arsene Keshkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. Thanks, Arsene.
Thank you, Maeve.